Thank you, Tiron. I really appreciate that, and I'd like to say how honored I am to be the guest poet tonight here at OVAIL. And my thanks to Joe Sweeney and Paul Casey, especially. It's just wonderful to be down here. It's a great honor for me. My wife and TZ and I come down to Cork about four times a year, and it's great being back tonight. I will read 11 poems, and all of them are from my first collection, which was launched in February 2014. And it's called Maiden Voyage. This is it here. And I have a number of copies, about, you know, six or seven, on sale at a reduced price of 10 euros each, in case any of you is interested. And I will start with the first three poems in the collection. The first is Looking for a Better Past, and it's dedicated to Philip King, who hosts The South Wind Blows on Radio 1. I'm a morning person, and I often listen to the music program at 4 a.m. on Thursdays. The poem begins with a quote from the show he did at the start of 2012. Looking for a better past. And here's the quote. It's January the 1st, and what have we to look forward to? Someone said to me the other day, there's no hope looking for a better past. Truer words were never spoken. That was from The South Wind Blows, 2012. But where would 1904 Dublin be without Joyce? Raglan Road without Kavanagh and Luke Kelly is just a road. No Yeats, the wild swans at cool, but a scattering of birds. This dark morning, in what otherwise is just a stone farmhouse where two 65-year-olds live, a restless tide of silent scribbling sees a poem set in 1912 rise and link past lives to our centennial present as Philip King's hushed, breathless words celebrate lock in amber, music and lives which otherwise are the less. Maybe just were. The second poem is titled Maiden Voyage, and this is the one that I was working on the morning that I heard that South Wind Blows. And it's based on the portrait on the cover of the book, Maiden Voyage. We had bought the drawing 35 years before in Berlin. And thanks to the date on the drawing, we always called the lady our Titanic lady. Here it is. To our Titanic lady, signed Carl Zaubert, 23rd December, 1911. Maiden Voyage. Well wrapped against bitter Berlin breezes, you set out for the studio of the young artist, his age same as the day, and on parchment, in charcoal, with chalk highlights, he etched your life-size head and shoulders portrait, surely a present given to another young man the next night to remember you by. Such a stylish age to come of age, and how your profile must have pleased, the great sweeping feathered hat as wide as your fur-warm shoulders, the confident clear gaze just touched with light on eye, nose, lips, and chin, looking west, 4 months from the maiden voyage that would leave Queenstown, April 11, sailing into history. We've always imagined your beauty on that great ship, not as in the film, cresting the bow, arms spread into the wind with a young Irish artist met on board, though the music is perfect. a century later, on stone in the back hall, your image under glass, night and day reflects us as we come and go. Your rich dark hair never graying like ours. Your soft left shoulder never turning. Your eyes ever west. Your ever warm life suspended on floating white, frozen in time. And now, the next poem is also about an object that has resonance for me. Christy Mahan's Loy. Into the barn last week for a whetstone, but emerged instead with a touchstone of sorts from behind a jumble of old tools. There was the long-handled loy made from a spade, rust and dirt nearly concealing the original green paint on the narrowed blade, but still a fine tool to woo young limber girls and fine prancing women, or for killing your da. Holding it in my matching rough garden hands, it cut through 30 years and a high wall to West Berlin, where I directed the Playboy of the Western World. The players, a worried group of young Americans, scared Playboy's strangeness wouldn't connect. But I insisted we tackle it uncut like the Shakespeare we studied. A glossary was added to the program for words like boring, the spit of, gob, tinker, the divil the one, wake, putchine, wished, and yes, loy, a farm tool for digging peat from a bog dried for fuel called turf. After long weeks of rehearsals and a near mutiny, nervous opening night and the lights dim to Irish music and then lights up, and slowly the lyrical comic coarse language wove its spell on actors as much as audience, wrapped from the richness of image and emotion that captured Sing's joyous, dark, raw old Ireland. Again next night, the last and after, we struck the set. Bar counter, sugans, settled dresser, turf fire, gone to the traditional oblivion of the stage. Later, at the cast party, Robin McDonald, who should have played Peggy Mike, presented a gift from them all, reading the quote, accent perfect, attached to a large bottle of Irish whiskey. It'd be a poor thing to have you eating your spuds dry. Hefting the loy in the mouth of the barn, in rainy sunlight, on our few wide and windy acres of rich Munster land, I wonder where they are. The students, now nearing 50, do fiddles or tin whistle, half-remembered lines ever take them back like me as I hold proudly, happily, the loy that never worked a bog but heard poetry. Now, a critical piece for me that led me to becoming a published poet, and then February last year having my first collection published. Back in 2009, I totally unexpectedly took first runner-up in Limerick's Cushla International Poetry Slam. I read two poems, and the first of them I had written that morning based on something that happened very early. As you no doubt know, slam poetry is a bit more, how can I say it, informal than other styles. So you've been warned. Life's a piece of shit when you look at it. Well before dawn, just up, half awake, rekindling the wood stove, when from the radio, always look on the bright side of life. All right! But wait, something strange. Strange orchestration. Not Monty Python. It's the D-Ball cover by Art Garfunkel with the replaced line, life's a counterfeit when you look at it. My ass. Hey Art, Paul and you have left your mark. Solitary despair on the Greyhound bus. The fighter still remains. The haunting Andy's panpipes. Sail on, silver girl, sail on by, that I wish I had sighted on our blonde Sue's wedding day. But Art, you shouldn't have messed with this song. The bright side of life is sacred ground. It triggers Friday afternoon beers with Bob. And later, TZ and Maureen too, down in my classroom, unwinding after the week's teaching. Both in our elements, Bob biology, me literature, merrily swapping tales from the trenches, playing with words. We'd hoist cheap bottles of Stuttgarter beer, or tip becoming your tip. Me, up yours, mate. He, up yours, mate. We, with a wire brush. And during those sessions sometimes, we played Python's irreverent song masterpiece, which obliterated any attempt to view life as serious or meaningful. And I laughed deeply with that brilliant teacher, the funniest man I have ever known. Until it ended. Spring break 2002, while I was in Russia. On a bird song, warming April evening, Bob reached the end of his rope, literally, in the stairwell down from his classroom. A week later, I had to deliver his eulogy to our still devastated community. Art Garfunkel, at times, life is indeed a piece of shit, not a counterfeit, especially when it erupts, splintering everything into before and after. And here in the dark, on this bitter morning, without that greatest line, I'm badly needing a laugh and not finding it. Thank you. I think we could use some comic relief, yeah. The next one I wrote in Germany in 1993 about a family night with our two kids, the oldest one visiting us back from his first semester in college in the States. Allies, Christmas Eve, 1993. Not the forecast of snow the next day, or Andy Williams singing it's the most wonderful time of the year, or two refrigerators bursting with food could put us in the proper holiday mood. First, there were no more nachos. Then Pat wanted early pumpkin pie. I've been away at college for 3.5 months. But it was like the video fight. Pat and Dad wanted Serpico, or Kane Mutiny, or The French Connection 1, but Mom and Sue wanted Amadeus. And after 10 minutes back and forth, Amadeus went in, but the picture was all static. So I told Pat to go get the cleaning tape, and as he handed it to me, he said, "Finally, we all agree on what tape we want." One more for some comic relief here. Besides being part of Limerick's poetry scene, I'm also a keen gardener of fruit and vegetables in our big haggard next to the chapel in our village. We have a small farming village that's very quiet, but lovely. And here's one of several poems in Maiden Voyage that grew from the garden experience. And the title comes from the adage, "There are more tears shed over answered prayers than unanswered prayers." Answered prayers in Eden. On his knees weeding in his private Eden next to the village chapel, one October day, the gardener prayed for something even more special. "Oh, Lordy, give me one new vegetable, as quick to seed from table as radishes, as tasty raw as mange two peas, as pest-free as the rainbow chard and as beautiful, as winter-hardy as kale, as fun for children as pumpkins on Halloween, as easy to harvest as Swedes, as wise as sage, as plentiful as thyme, as prolific as cucumbers, as lovely sounding as angelica, rosemary, shallots, courgettes." And like the tomatillo, after it dies, may its beautiful skeleton cage rattle with seeds, spring ready. And as a poet gardener, it's got the sound special too. As feisty as rocket, as quick off the mark as runner beans, with the internal rhyme of zucchini, ichiki, kuri, gourd, the alliteration of broad beans, Florence, fennel, iambic, calla, flower, Brussels sprouts, as multi-layered as onions. And as a dirty-minded guy gardener, I want it to be as playful body as ripe melons, as randy as the widow's consolation cucumbers, as pun-ready as going out to take a leak. Amen. His white breath words disappeared into air, and suddenly the whole garden was overwhelmed by a strange new vegetable, as hard to weed as onions and strawberries, as ready to bolt as spinach, as tough to wash as Jerusalem artichokes, and as fart generating, as prone to blight as lumper potatoes, as attractive to slugs as lettuce, as mouth and stool reddening as beetroot, as hand ravaging to pick as gooseberries. "Oh, Lordy," the gardener moaned, looking up to heaven. It was my Eve that made me include the body bits. If I remove them, can you answer my other prayers, please?" "No," he thundered, "as much as the next guy I likes a bit of clean dirt. You are punished because your wish list left out my favorite herb. You committed the oregano sin." I'm going to do two literary tributes now. And the first one I wrote 26 years ago after buying a special book in California. Let me find the page here. Let's on finding Seamus Heaney, Poems and a Memoir at Moe's Books on Telegraph Avenue, Berkeley, summer 1989. There was his name. Square and simple, gold pressed into the peak brown leather of a folio volume. Freed from the slipcase, it clings to the touch. My hand reels concentric circles, splayed borders and crosses, stone passages from Newgrange alive in the slanting dusty light of Moe's. Late afternoon, murmurings and smothered noises, lost in reverie, the center sounded. Opening now irregular edges of bond, rich cream fields leisurely surround tight tracts of print, erupting bog faces, turf cuttings, ruts, fogs, the slap field sunk clutter and squelch of rural Ireland. A water stain spreading the upper corners of the early 60s uncollected poems cut the dollar value from 120 to 40. As if a little damp could hurt this word hoard that sings of bog holes, wind-frayed ropes of pump water, the monkfish seas of the great skellig, the water a baptism, confirmation of more worth. Himself has signed it at the end. He touched this book that I now touch. Over the smaller, confident hand of Thomas Flanagan, who so intimidated me just a half mile away in 1969. I had sought his Irish name as I studied independently Singh, Kavanaugh, and Yeats, mostly to fathom the world of a clear-eyed girl from a stone farmhouse near Loch Gur, met hitchhiking in Europe the previous summer, my bride the next. Flanagan's introduction, like his begrudged grave, of indication of sorts. The living poet I most admire, esteemed by this sternest critic. My muses abide, still reflected in blue eyes, revived anywhere by Singh, Kavanaugh, Yeats, and Heaney, or wind, mixed sunlight and showers, which fleet best across small, stone-walled fields of green. The next poem kind of wrote itself when I learned that an Irish actor had died. Feast of the Epiphany, 2010, to Ronald Donnelly. BBC TV Scotland saved our two quiet New Years. The bold hogmanay, bagpipes, drums, and fiddles, fireworks, but best of all, minutes past 12, lead-crystalled champagne in our hands, Burns' Auld Lang Syne, sung softly, more poignant each year on this night to look back, remembering those we've lost, drinking not with, but to them. Scotland's plowman poet is honored again on 25 January, Burns Night, a feast of haggis and single malt, poetry and song. Joyce's 1904 Dublin is celebrated on Bloomsday, and like Burns, there should be a Joyce night, too. Each 6th of January, it unfolds quietly in front of the fire in our old kitchen. Muscadet for her, single malt for me, as we feast on John Huston's last masterpiece, The Dead, set on this night. Huston died before it was released. His swan song is Joyce's Dublin dinner party on Usher's Island, where not much seems to happen beyond their petty, separate vanities, until the exquisitely recited Donal Ogue transports a few of them and Gabriel's speech so fretted over is happily behind him, and everything winds down along with comic relief from poor drunken Freddie Malins, one of the last guests to leave. But the sting is in the tail. As she comes down the stairs, Greta, by chance, hears Mr. Darcy sing The Lass of Aucrum. Houston frames her in stained glass, lost to this world. Back at their hotel, still distracted, she relives a haunting memory from her youth and collapses in tears to sleep, leaving Gabriel to his shattering epiphany. Life imitates art. As we watch this story unfold on this night each year, we are further moved as, following its director, one by one the actors too are becoming shades. Donald McCann, Frank Patterson, Sean McClory, Dan O'Herlihy, and on 4 January, Donald Donnelly, who played Freddie Malins. Gabriel's epiphany is ours. Okay, only 3 more to go now. We lived in West Berlin for 8 years. I taught for the U.S. forces overseas, basically high schools. I taught in Oxfordshire in England for 7 years, and then in West Berlin before the wall fell for 8 years, and then in Stuttgart, a total of 34 years. And we, after the wall unexpectedly fell in 89, 3 years after we left for Stuttgart, we went back some months later, and like many others, we took hammers and chisels to what remained of the wall, die Mauer, for souvenirs. This next poem, and this is true, actually came from a nightmare vision that I had one night after we returned. And it starts out with a quote about a place in Berlin, Der Teufelsberg, is the Devil's Mountain, built by the Allies. It is the highest hill in Berlin, amassed from 12 million cubic meters of rubble from over 400,000 buildings destroyed in World War II. Walpurgisnacht, Berlin moon rising, April 30, 1990. Ceaseless chipping, hammering on die Mauer, the wall, a guilty frenzy on previously forbidden ground, the slow yield of pitiful pieces, grudged respect for this disappearing gray conglomerate scar, oblique views through its twisted iron skeleton. Imagine seeing der Brandenburger Tor from underneath, stone facade over brick arching upwards like New Year's rockets. The Soviet rockets, howitzers, British and American planes shattered Berlin in 45. The jagged, gate-jawed ruins still haunting in black and white. Scarved Hausfraus seared from coal bunker vengeance meted out by drunken Red Army hordes. By day, hard-scrabble chipping mortar, brick by brick, block by block, in the heart of the Third Reich. Tonight, the last in April, Hitler's last too, a full moon rises above this new Berlin, over Mercedes, Star, Ost, Bahnhof, Sitte, Foch, Potsdam, Funkturm, Kleielee, Kurfürstendamm, Grunewald, Ganymede, Charlottenburg, Unter den Linden, and the light gathers, thickens, as the stone dust slowly pulls up, forming a vast vortex, and in one great Wagnerian heave, sucks the wall complete, and and miles from Reichstag and bunker Der Teufelsberg, the cracked facade shards fan the Siecle out Berlin, asleep, grass covered now for kites and sleds. Suddenly it too stirs in the pale light and pulls slowly up this forthcoming gathered memory and desire and links Die Mauer and Der Teufelsberg until a giant, gaunt, gray, spread-winged eagle unfolds, hovers, circling, circling, waiting for where, which way to land. The penultimate poem is set on the outskirts of our village. And it's based on something that happened in 1973. And it's dedicated to Willie Lavery, who died May 13, 1977, aged 81. That trembling world. Don't go near the bog. You can't trust its surface. But that hot August day in 73, old Willie offered to show me where turf was dug in the 40s and 50s, and where he and Mick Casey swam as children. I drove us to Ballinard Burial Ground, and Willie's shod, Schlon and his father's crescent sickle for him, stout walking stick and shovel for me, we headed down through Garrett Berry's fields and hedges, down towards the irregular pool-speckled basin, its greens and browns like thick, half-crusted syrup. Soon, near a straight edge, saying nothing, Willie walked out onto water. His boots just 8 inches of funnel tops, the surface rippling 10 feet in concentric circles on the impossible great mattress. He told me to follow his much lighter weight. Thinking quicksand, I set out like a spider, legs and supports askew, and watched by Willie and the ghosts who had harvested this ground, we explored, sustained by the near hidden borders of old turf. After, in his element, he coolly, expertly cut 8 or 10 sods, pitching them out to dry, not that they were ever collected. Sweating hard in the still heat, after false starts, I cut 4 or 5. Just before leaving, promising the greatest water, he led me to a small spring, cleared its source with his sickle, and we each drank 2 shovel blades of the sweetest liquid. 40 years now, and on my walks to the graveyard, the abandoned bog beckons, its pools still reflecting sky. Some days the gentle wind, like the near silent footing of turf in that trembling world, just below where many of them now lie, including Willie. I'm now going to read the last poem. And again, thank you so much for the honor of being here tonight. This poem is the last one in Maiden Voyage, and it's dedicated to my dear wife, Teasy. And in fact, the book, the dedication at the start, I say to Teasy, my first and abiding muse. And she wanted to come tonight, but she had real bad pains in her back, and we decided better that she didn't do it, but shame she wasn't here tonight. But here it is, the last one. And again, thanks for being such a super audience. Before we disappear, after life, The Japanese film we saw a few weeks ago unfolded fitfully, but such a movie premise. After we die, but before we disappear, we must each declare a moment from our life to live with eternally. Mine would be one with T.C. O'Dwyer that first summer, that winter in Ireland. Before me now is a picture of you in a blue coat wrapped against the cold December of 68 here in Ballinard, cattle grazing the green pasture behind the lichen-covered stone wall under leafless chestnut trees, your brown hair gathered with a red scarf, your left glove off, surely to hold my hand as we slowly walked that quiet road, lost to everything, everyone but each other. That moment will do. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Tom.